What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and for the next half hour, we'll be discussing a big topic, the state of love on college campuses. And I might add, this probably applies to the millennial generation and maybe even to people in their early 30s. But the focus here is on one particular college campus and one particular professor. And we're fortunate to be joined by one of the nation's true experts and contrarians on the topic. And that's Kerry Cronin, a professor of philosophy at Boston College. Kerry, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, Kerry, first off, you're a philosopher. And so love, by the way, love is not something that philosophers ignore. But dating, probably. And I'm not sure Plato dug deep into dating. but how did you become such an expert that students, your the people and the kids you teach, mentor, coach, dubbed you the love doctor? Is it through the philosophy classes or something more? Tell us a little bit about this title you've earned at Boston College.
Well, it is kind of funny to me. I don't consider myself to be an expert on this, but I love talking to students about their lives and about their choices and the ways that they make their life decisions and their moral decisions. I think it does. It has come. This whole thing, me being involved in this and talking to students about it, had emerged in the context of philosophy classes that I teach. We're looking at texts that, in which we're thinking about friendship and relationships and the importance of that in a community and in a person's life and flourishing. And so we sort of get to these kinds of questions all the time. But it was conversations with students outside of class, actually, that led me to talk really specifically about dating and hookup culture and to find out what the heck is going on out there. And students over the years, I've been talking to students about this for 8 to 10 years now, very openly, and they have just been wonderful in telling, in being very upfront about what dating and hookup culture is like in college, how they feel about it, what their anxieties, their fears, and their desires are. So it's been wonderful. Everything I know, I've learned from them.
And how did you stumble upon the specific talks you had about dating and relationships? How did you stumble upon this absence in their lives?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I had a conversation with a group of students about, gosh, it had to be 10 years ago now. I had worked with some students on a student program, and we went out for ice cream after the program just because it had gone well, and I was the facilitator of a discussion. It was a public discussion on faith, actually. And so we went out for ice cream afterwards, and they were all seniors. There were 8 seniors, and we were just talking about life and life after graduation and that sort of thing. And I, after talking about jobs and grad schools and different options, I said, you know, what about the people you're dating? And I got a real blank stare from them all. And I thought, what's going on? And they said, oh, we don't do that dating thing anymore. We just don't do that. That's not really done here. And I pressed them on it. And after that, I just started asking questions regularly about it. And students told me a lot about hookup culture. I learned things that I thought I knew about. I learned things that I never knew about. I've thought about these things with students for years since.
Well, and it's interestingly enough, you learned, I guess, that the hookup culture, just as years ago there were dating rules, Kerry,
yes,
that the hookup culture itself had rules.
You know, what I heard from students a lot at the beginning was, well, you know, we don't really date. We would like to keep things much more casual, and that there was this idea that the hookup culture was the casual thing, and that was the easy thing. But when I listened to them, I realized that it actually looks like it's super casual and that there are no rules, but there are lots of rules. And I say to students all the time, and they all agree, you have to know the rules to participate in hookup culture. Everybody knows them, but nobody speaks about the rules. And if you break the rules, you're out. You know, nobody wants to have anything to do with you. So,
right.
So they figure the rules out pretty quick. And the rules include, you know, so typically when I talk to students, I'll run through some, like, the top 10 rules, you know, rules like, don't talk about it while it's happening. Don't ask, what does this mean? You know, you got to learn how to use texting. You know, don't stay over. Know where your earrings are so you can grab them when you're leaving. Know where your shoes are. You know, don't be awkward. You know, there's all kinds of things that are part and parcel of the hookup culture that students know and that they figure out the rules. But as I say to them, isn't it strange that we think there are no rules and that dating is so formal and everybody's so terrified of asking somebody out for a cup of coffee, but to get involved in hookup culture looks like it's ordinary and casual and that there aren't rules, but we know that
we know there are. You know, I want to play I want to play a clip from you. I'm going to hold on a response and then we'll get the response on the other side of a break, Carrie. But it's it's a clip of you in a talk you gave to the Love and Fidelity Network. And then again, we'll talk to you about it right after the break.
I know that students at my university are incredibly ambitious, smart, wonderful, socially just, interested in other people until about Thursday afternoon, right? And then the nighttime culture sort of gets going, and suddenly it's a whole different scene.
It's a whole different scene. And we're going to get to the other side of that scene in a bit. We're joined by Carrie Cronin. She's a professor of philosophy at Boston College. But she's known at the school as the love doctor. And it's because of some of the things she's been doing with the kids as it relates to their lives and to this thing that for millennium men and women did, called dating. But the millennials, it turns out, are not doing much of. And I think this will interest every parent listening. It'll certainly excite the millennials listening, because this is their lives we're talking about, and not in judgment. None of that here. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, and more after this moment with the Love Doctor.
I say, hey, I'll be gone today, but I'll be back home around the way. It seems like everywhere I go, the more I see, the less I know. I say, hey, I'll be gone today, but I'll be back.
This is Lee Habib, and the subject right now is dating, or the lack thereof. Something very new, actually, to millennials. They're not doing it like we used to. Why? What's going on? Nobody knows about this better. No one's dug deeper into the subject. You don't know her, but now you do. And we're going to get to know her better over the coming months, and I hope years, because I don't think you can ever stop talking about a subject like this. We're talking to Carrie Cronin, who's a professor of philosophy at Boston College, but is known as the love doctor by the students there, who adore her for daring them to do something that people have been doing for centuries. And it's a little thing called dating. Where we last picked up, Carrie was describing this Thursday night culture. The kids are a certain kind of wonderful child all week long. And then, well, the werewolves of London come out, so to speak, and something starts to happen. Well, let's continue, Carrie. Go from there.
So that's funny. That's a great description of it. I often say to students, you know, the students I work with and live with here at Boston College are lovely. They are just hardworking, lovely young people, and they're eager to please, and they're eager to work hard and compete, and they hold a door for you at 50 paces. It's exhausting how nice they are. But then the nighttime culture is really aggressive. It's very aggressive in terms of competitive drinking, and the hookup culture is very aggressive, and they feel it. They're I find, and we all know, that college students in the United States now are very much affected by anxiety and stress, and I think this has a lot to do with it. They're busy in their daytime lives, but at night it's rough out there, and they're trying to find their way and find their work out important questions about who they are and what they want in their lives. But there isn't a culture that's helping them at all.
No, and you know it's always been tough to be 18. So let's not forget that. And it's hard for us at 30, 40, I'm in my 50s to remember. Sure. But my goodness, think about it just for a minute, and you'll wish you weren't 18 again after you think about it, actually. But for those of us who are unaware, Gary, can you paint a picture of what this, quote, nighttime hookup culture and scene looks like? And why exactly it's so appealing in the end, or maybe not appealing, but what draws these students into it?
Sure. I think, you know, what happened on the college campus scene, I think, and I'm mostly talking about 4-year residential colleges, because I think at when I go to schools and at which the populations are not residential students, you don't see this as much. People are working part-time jobs or working to get through school, and they don't have time for this. But at 4-year residential schools, students will often, you know, they come off of really stressful days. And the weekend, on the weekends, they pre-game parties, which means, you know, they get drunk before they even go to parties, mostly because, for instance, our campus is mostly a dry campus, and so they are ostensibly not drinking on campus,
right.
But they have to find their ways to drink. So they go to parties, and they've got to get drunk fast. You know, the keg party script is you got to get drunk fast before the RAs or the police come and break it up. So it's much more of a shots culture, if you will. You know, it used to be, years ago, beer was the drink of choice for, you know, Animal House, kind of that scenario. But now they're drinking hard liquor because that's easier to get in to a dorm. They're drinking hard liquor fast, and women are drinking or binge drinking at the same rates that men are, and so everybody's trashed, and everybody's sort of hyper competitive because these young people, these millennials, have been competing their whole lives.
You bet.
You know, this is definitely the organization kid that David Brooks described years ago.
Yep.
These students they're highly programmed, they're highly competitive, highly achieving, and they want to achieve in their social lives too. And this script, the hookup script. Yeah. Has really become such a dominant script, and it's associated with the keg party script.
But would it be wrong for me to assume also that these high achievers are also, in a sense, conformists? I mean, they so want to get approval from their superiors, from their teachers, that in the end they'll conform to whatever the norm is in this respect?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely, because they've been taught, you know, they've been taught throughout their academic careers and their sports careers. You know, many of the students we have here were varsity athletes in high school. They're, you know, they know how to find out what the formula of success is and get themselves there.
Yep.
They know how to do it. And hookup culture gives them check marks. You know, I've hooked up with this many people. I've hooked up with this person who I think is good looking, this person who other people want. You know, it gives them markers that they can achieve. And as I say to students, this is a movement to an exterior set of check boxes. You know, this is, but it has lots of ramifications on your interior life.
You bet. Lots of consequences. And we're talking, by the way, folks, with Kerry Cronin. And she's a professor of philosophy at Boston College. But on the side, she teaches a dating course there that's standing room only. The kids come from everywhere because she actually challenges them to leave this hookup culture and try and do something actually that turns out to be really daring, and that is to ask someone out on a date. Before we get into that, though, Kerry, what are the 5 types of hookups? And folks, parents, take notes. Talk to your kids about this. Well, what are they?
Right. So over the years, when I give talks to students, I find that what you have to do when you're talking to students about this, so that you're not coming off in a really judgmental way and putting them in a defensive posture, is you got to use humor, and you've got to ask them to tell you what's going on. And what I've heard from students is that there's lots of different reasons and types of hookups. And I often say to students, so there's the pure hookup, which is a one-time deal. You know, you just meet a person at a party or you know, and you hook up with them and that's that, and you never hear from them again. Or maybe you see them on campus and you do the sort of campus look away, which is what our students call it. You just kind of look in the other direction or pretend yep. you're looking on your phone. There's the regular hookup, which is, you know, you hooked up with somebody and then maybe you see them at a party the next week or the week after that, and you kind of think, well, that worked out well, and you get a look and you understand that that's going to happen again and maybe a couple of times. Then there's friends with benefits, which I always say to students, that's crazy. That's not what I do with my friends. And Aristotle doesn't describe friendship that way.
So No, he doesn't.
then there's different sort types of hookups, like revenge hookups or after you break up, reuniting with the old flame hookups. There's, you know, and actually there's many more than five. And the reason that I know there are many more than five is because every time I go to a school, students add to the list, which is scary. But when you can get them to laugh about it, that's also when you can get them to start reflecting on it. When you will laugh with them and say, isn't this a little strange and ridiculous and actually not what you really long for and what you really desire?
Oh, you bet. You know, I'm a Christian, but one of the books that influenced my life the most, actually, and weirdly, because I tell my friends this and they go, what? But it was Martin Buber's I and Thou. And it's always that space between the I and Thou that we can draw people in. And too often people of faith don't allow that space to not only other people of faith, but people not of faith.
We
have about a minute here. We're going to hold you over and do another segment, Kerry, because we just can't stop talking about this. But what do you think is the cause of this present culture full of hookups but absent of love?
Yeah, that's the deep question. That's the $64,000 question. I think people are looking for an easy way to try to put their toe into, you know, the water and try to find love without any risk. So when I talk to students about dating, actually, it ends up being mostly about courage, not love.
Yeah, but you know, in the end, what did Aristotle say about courage? It's the first requirement for all of the other virtues. Or
Absolutely.
Something like that. And how can you have love without courage? We're going to hold here and we're going to continue this fascinating conversation about our kids, about ourselves in the end, and about life. Because any of us who've ever said, I love you to anybody and meant it, know they're the three hardest words to say. And if you don't hear them back, my goodness, this is the hardest thing in the world, and that's why you don't say it, because you're not sure you'll hear it back. We're talking to Kerry Cronin, and she is the doctor of love at Boston College, and she also happens to teach philosophy at Boston College. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and more after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, we're talking to Kerry Cronin, and she's a professor of philosophy at Boston College. But she has an even more serious job there in some respects, and that's counseling and coaching her young students how to do a thing called date, and in the end, how to think about love, because we all think about it, and it's a scary thing. And Kerry, thanks so much for joining us for the hour here. You bet. I wanted to read to you something from that Love and Fidelity Network interview that one girl had shared, because I think it's fascinating, and then we can pick up on this love theme. Here's what she said. She said, I have loved my time at Boston College. I have grown intellectually. I've made incredible friends. I've had amazing relationships in Boston. I have a job lined up. I'm a better sister, a better daughter, a better roommate, a better friend now. And then she said, quote, but the only area in my life in which I have not grown is the area of understanding of what I want out of love, what I want out of romance, what I understand about my own desire, my own passions. In this area, not only have I not developed, I think I have regressed. I think I am more scared, more unsure of myself. And I know myself on these things less than I did when I graduated from high school. My goodness, what a self-aware human being. What a beautiful human being to even write this. Carrie?
Yeah, I remember that young woman very well. She was actually part of a focus group that we ran here when we were trying to figure out, some of the administrators here at Boston College ran focus groups with students to try to figure out what was going on in terms of hookup culture and dating and relationships and sexuality. And so we had a number of really wonderful students who came and shared really deep and profound reflections like that with us. It was stunning to me. And when I heard that young woman speak, honestly, I was heartbroken. Because, you know, we pride ourselves, especially here, this is a Jesuit university, we pride ourselves on educating the whole person. And to me, that's unacceptable. We're not doing our job if we're not helping students to navigate the most important parts of their lives.
Yep.
And that's just heartbreaking to me.
You know, man is not an economic animal alone. And, you know, the great Alexander Solzhenitsyn leaves a Soviet gulag, comes to the United States, and everybody thinks he's going to hammer communism. But he does quite the opposite. He gives a lecture to everybody about the downsides of capitalism. He's no friend of communism, but he talks about the material and how the material can actually squelch out the spiritual and kill love. And no one was expecting that from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and why it's one of the great talks in American history. By the way, you can go to Great American Rhetoric, and you can look up Solzhenitsyn, and look under A, not S. That's how they put everything there. We want to play a clip for you, Carrie, again from that talk at the Love and Fidelity Network, and pick up on this duty and responsibility of a Jesuit school, for goodness sake, teaching the whole person.
I am terrified to start recognizing that universities and colleges today are places of great opportunity, great ideas, great ambition and achievement, but not great love. That between the ages of 18 and 22, or 23 if you really just need to take an extra year, or 21 if you're like really excelling, like while you're here in college, this is a great time to fall in love, but you probably won't. And it's not because you don't want to, but it is because there is a culture that has sprung up, that has emerged, that's not going to support you finding a great love alongside finding great ideas, great opportunities, great conversations, great friendships, great ambitions, great accomplishments. To find a great love is also something we would really like to help you with. You kind of have to do it on your own, but we're certainly not helping to scaffold that a culture that would help you do that.
I'm not sure what else you can add, but tell me what really what dug you in there, and why did universities not talk about this, and what happened?
No, that's a great question too. I mean, I think in the United States, the universities, colleges and universities have really moved away from the in loco parentis model, and so by and large, even though parents are entrusting for a lot of money, parents are entrusting their young sons and daughters to our care. The general rule of thumb is stay out of their business, and there's something important in that insight.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was, I think we went to a far extreme on that, and I find that college students really want a lot of help, and they're not afraid of older adults helping them with things. Unlike previous generations who didn't trust anybody over the age of 30,
right.
I find that millennials crave conversations about their lives. They crave coaching, if you will. I find that when I talk to young male students, for instance, as well as young female students, actually, when I think about it, they are really receptive to life coaching sort of attitudes. And they the more that I talk to them about this, the more they want to meet with me and talk to me about this. And so they're really craving some help, but I think that we're assuming that they don't want any help and that they don't want to be told how to live. Well, as a matter of fact, they don't want us to be overly directive or overly moralizing or judgmental, but they want conversation. And it's, you know, it's not easy to walk that fine line in having conversations that are helpful but not intrusive, you know. But I think faculty and administrators and staff members who are happy in their own lives and who are really who have their own children, perhaps, who are going through these kinds of things, they can be really helpful. But most people are sort of nervous about talking about these kinds of things.
You know, I'd tell you a story. I was on a plane well over a year ago. Attractive young lady was sitting next to me, and I was writing a column and battling out a column about love. And I was getting close to my little girl's birthday, and I had never known anything like that kind of love for a child. I'd known a love for a woman, finally, and I had waited way too long to know that. Because I actually was a millennial before there were millennials in this respect. I was afraid of saying I love you to somebody. And I confess this in this column. I had never properly said it to a woman until I was 41 years old. Because I was afraid of the rejection. Who knows why? I don't know, but I didn't. And I write about this. And then I get to the part of the column where I'm typing. And I'm going to read you some of the words because I could feel her reading this. And as she was reading it, I could feel her crying as I was reading it. And I wrote, as I quoted a line from Julian Barnes, and Barnes had said, "I was 32 when we met and 62 when she died," speaking of his wife. "She was the heart of my life and the life of my heart. You put two things together," Julian Barnes wrote, "that have not been put together before, and the world has changed." And then I wrote, "That's the power of love. The world is changed by it. Without love, the world is barren. The day my wife told me she was pregnant, my world changed again. In what is the greatest love song ever written about childbirth, the narrator in Bruce Springsteen's Living Proof says this: in his mother's arms, it was all the beauty I could take, like the missing words to some prayer that I could never make. It was and is all the beauty I can take, watching our daughter grow and laugh and play, the heart of my life, the life of my heart, the answer to a prayer I never even knew to pray." I turned around and she was weeping. And I started a conversation as deep as I'd ever had with another human being who was about to get married and was crying, she told me, because I asked her why. Her husband just told her she did not want to have kids. Her husband-to-be. On the back end, we're going to talk about what happened there, Carrie, and then talk to you about some of those same kinds of conversations I am sure you have had with these young people. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And we're talking for the hour about dating, about love, with the love doctor and a professor of philosophy at Boston College, Kerry Cronin.
Well, she was standing by the highway in her boots and silver spurs, gonna hitchhike to the yellow moon.
She don't care about what's in style. She just likes the way he smiles. It takes more than marble and tile. Living on love. Living on love.
This is Lee Habib, and you're listening to Alan Jackson. And it was a day when it was that simple. And it was never simple, so let's not go back and be too nostalgic. But back in the day, my parents, so many folks I know, the guy met a girl, he asked her out, and if it was right, they moved along and they started a family. No existential dread, no I'm not ready yet, no let's hook up. Just didn't exist. Or if it did, it wasn't codified into the culture. And we're talking for the hour with the doctor of love, who also happens to be the professor of philosophy at Boston College. And that's a nickname she's been given, by the way, on campus because of this class we're about to describe and discuss. Carrie Cronin joins us. Carrie, so you've diagnosed the problem, you've gotten to know the kids, and you start a dating class. Talk about that.
Well, it wasn't actually a dating class. Maybe I would get fired for that, but it was a senior capstone seminar. You know, many colleges and universities have these capstone seminars. It was a one-credit-only, pass-fail seminar, once-a-week meeting with juniors and seniors to sort of discuss, you know, so what things have you discovered about yourself and life in your education? What questions do you still have? And we talked about sort of large things like the future and the role of money in your life and that sort of thing. And I used to save 2 weeks to discuss relationships, friendships, and romantic relationships. And after I had discovered that the hookup culture was such a dominant script, I decided in one of these seminars that I would ask my students to go on a traditional date. And they all seemed pretty excited about that. The first group was about 15 students in a class, and so I said, oh, you know, could you by the end of the semester could I want you to ask somebody out and go on a date. And so week after week, they came back, and they kept talking about it. Oh, I don't know who to ask. You know, I don't know how to do this, blah, blah, blah. And I kept wondering why this was so complicated. Well, we get to the end of the semester, and only one of the 15 students had been able to do it, which I thought was really shocking because, again, these are really bright, wonderful, beautiful students. And so the next semester, during the drop ad period, I said to them, you're going to have an assignment to ask somebody on a date, go on a date, and write a reflection about the date, and you have to do this assignment. I won't pass you if you don't.
It was a requirement.
It was a requirement. I had to make it a requirement because I realized they would just keep talking about it and never doing it. So I said, you could drop the class right now. I think three students dropped out right away, but three more came in, and so that second semester, everybody did it, but it was sort of a mess. They didn't know what they were doing. We had lots of students would come in and tell funny stories about it. So by the third semester, I sort of wisened up. Now, when I give this assignment in my freshman to my freshmen who take a great books class with me, and I give them a sheet of paper that has instructions. I had to come up with a set of instructions because what I realized was that hookup culture had not only become the dominant social script, dating as a script had been completely lost. They didn't know how to do it.
Yep.
And so I needed to give them a set of instructions, so they have to follow a set of my rules. And on the backside of the sheet is a list of 50 inexpensive dates around Boston, you know, so that it doesn't have to be a burden.
Yeah.
And so from there, we've gone in every semester. I give it now to freshmen because, you know, freshmen are, my students this year will have this assignment in February. I make it an optional assignment. They'll get bonus points for it on an exam. And so they all jump on that. I had students who started coming to that class where it was required, and students would say to me openly in front of other students, I am taking this class so that you will make me go on a date. I want to do this.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And I would say, or you could just go on a date. You don't need to take a whole class just to do that. But it's so outside of the norm that they need an excuse.
Well, it's interesting, Carrie. What's interesting is that it seems to me they're more at ease hooking up than just
sure
asking somebody out. And that's remarkable. I wanted to rip through some of these rules of yours, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And one
yeah.
of them, by the way, like on the top of it all, is that obviously it's alcohol free, because we yeah. all know that what the students use alcohol for does not at all lend itself to getting to know someone. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's yep. to not know them. That's why
right.
we do it, and allow us to do things we wouldn't do but for the alcohol. So here are the nine rules. You must ask someone who you are legitimately interested in, and you must ask them in person. Text can be sent to arrange a time and place, but the invitation must be extended face-to-face. Two, the date should last between 60 and 90 minutes, no more, no less. It should be a daytime date. You must pay for a date is four, but you should spend no more than $10. Five, there's no alcohol. Six, no physical interaction. Seven, you are allowed to say that it is not for an assignment, that it is for an assignment. Eight, you can only divulge your plan with three people. Nine, when you ask the person, plan for your date no more than 3 days in advance. And 10, optional, submit a two-page reflection paper to Professor Cronin while this assignment is ungraded, and it would be impossible to ensure its completion. It is a worthwhile endeavor. So go forth, students of Boston College, and find love. And if not love, then at least a story. That is so delightful, and I'm just shocked that we've come to this, but thank you for doing it. What's the reaction now? You've gone from 15 students. How many students are interested in this now at Boston College?
Oh, well, you know, that's the most fun. The most fun thing that I realized that happened, is this. I actually am, in any given semester, I'm giving the dating assignment to maybe 25 students. But although I give a lecture on campus each year, and usually there's three to 400 students at that lecture, and I say, if you're here, you have the dating assignment now. But the interesting thing is that I found that happened was not that just 15 or 25 or even 300 students went on dates. What happened was, as soon as the dating assignment was on a piece of paper, students would bring it back to their dorm rooms, their apartments, and here most of the upper class students live in apartment style suites, and so they have six or eight roommates. And so what was happening was they were bringing it back to their apartments, and people were discussing it. It became such a buzz.
Wow.
And it really is. Everybody knows here, if students start to ask you out, they'll often hear someone respond, oh, is this a Cronin date? So, and I always say to students, that's fine.
That is
fine.
Blame
it on me.
Exactly.
You know, because that'll make you feel a little less nervous, and it can be funny and something to talk about for the first 5 minutes of the date and laugh about. That's great. Make it a fun thing.
It's
supposed to be fun.
It is supposed to be fun, and it's delight. It's a delight, and it's supposed to be scary, too. And think
exactly.
about how many scary things are fun. You know, we go up in gigantic slides and pummel on down and pay money for that, but that's dating. Let's face it. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, you have all these kids who've done these dates. Can you talk about some student reflections from their dates? Give us a couple of, you know, what have you learned from your students? What have you taught them, and what have you learned from them?
Oh, absolutely. I have learned so much from them. It's outrageous how much I have learned from them. I've got a locked file drawer full of these reflections. And one of the things that I want to point out that I do in the class, too, is they're not only giving me their reflections after they've gone on a date, but we find class time for them to talk about it with each other and tell the story of their dating. And what they mostly want to talk about is the story of the ask. That asking someone out in person is the big hurdle, and it's the thing that they love to retell. And what I've found in reflections is some of my favorites are pieces of student reflections have to do with how anxious they feel during the ask. I had a student years ago who wrote this beautiful reflection on asking a guy out, and she described it thus. She said, "My heart was pounding and my palms were sweating as I approached my target." And when I read it, I thought, "Uh-oh, wait a minute, what's going on?" But these are the kinds of ways that they feel, and they write beautifully.
But you know, do you know what's really going on there? I think what's going on there is it's the red badge of courage. People love to write about that which they overcome. This makes them proud. And my goodness, that's better than, hey, here's how I hooked up. And now it's one of those dark memoirs about how someone took too many pills and offed herself. Carrie, I can't tell you.
You know, your point about stories is absolutely correct. One of the things I say to students about hooking up is that's part of the game of hooking up, right? Is to, you know, on Sunday morning or Monday morning, telling the story of who you hooked up with on the weekend and getting the points for it and the social status for
it. Yep.
But telling the story of going on a date, students will say, wow, people came up to me and congratulated me for having asked somebody out, and people are impressed that I did that. They're experiencing their own bravery, their own courage, and, as I often point out to them, you're for the first time asking for what it is you truly long for, what you really want, what you are nervous about, and what you think maybe this could really lead to something.
And what we were almost encoded by God to ask for, too.
That's right.
Carrie Cronin, thank you so much for what you do. In fact, one couple even got married because of the work that this professor did. The Doctor of Love, Professor of Philosophy at Boston College. Carrie Cronin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Lee. It was really a joy.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every night, we love doing... Well, I think I'm hearing water sounds. I'm not sure if I am. I don't think I am, but...
Not yet.
What we like to do is segment...
Blah, 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 blah.
There you go. There it is. Last time we did it, we got a toilet. You never know what you're going to get now. And that sounded like a plunger, but it is a water sound. And it's our water cooler segment. Just the stuff we like to talk about while we're just hanging around our office. And subjects that hopefully you can talk around your water cooler with at work if you have one. And if you're just doing a construction project, well, you know, just hanging around, just eating a sandwich. And, well, earlier today we were talking about, well, they caught me on a rant. Off mic, we thought the mics were down. Jesse always keeps them up. And we were just having a discussion about, well, of all things, milk and ice. And things just went in a strange direction. Here was us. Well, before.
You like your milk on the rocks, don't you?
I love my milk.
Milk with ice? That's interesting.
Oh, no. It's once you've done this, you've been living it. I understand. It's not milk
with ice.
It's
like beer with ice. It's just...
No. Yeah. Hear how to do this.
A rant. About
it. So, no, this isn't a rant.
Up to the mic. I mean, we're
it's
rolling.
Very serious stuff. You take, you start, you put some ice in something like either a bowl and a lot of it. You fill the bowl to the lid with ice. You pour your milk into that bowl, but that's not where you're going to drink your milk. Mm-hmm. You're just preparing your milk to be drank. You keep it in the ice for about 2 minutes, no longer,
serious.
Because then it'll start to coagulate. It'll freeze. After 2 minutes, take it, get something to hold the ice, then pour that ice, strain milk through the ice into a glass. Mm-hmm. And if the glass is chilled but not frozen, even better. And then have a hot pancakes with that milk. Mm. If you want, put one or two cubes on the top.
Yeah.
Because it won't melt. Because now the milk is properly cold, so that ice will not melt. It'll take a lot longer. Yeah. And then you will have had ice, really cold, cold milk. And once you do it, I literally can't drink even cool milk anymore.
Who told you to do that?
A restaurateur in Pittsburgh who did it to all his milk.
Huh. Wow.
He did it to all of his drinks. And he also had special ice. And everybody said his drinks were the best. But he had this ice machine that actually cost a fortune. And it cut a cubed ice. And it was like this crystal meth ice. It left no aftertaste. It melted incredibly slow. And ice, once it's like 4 hours old in the refrigerator, picks up the smells.
Yeah, definitely.
12 hours later, it's going to kill you in a really well-mixed drink. Mm-hmm. So when you're shaking that martini and you don't have great ice, that's crap gets into the... So he was actually a mixologist before there was such a thing. And Coca-Cola, he was freakish about. The Coke had to be cold before it was poured under the ice. It's warm Coke on ice tastes different. And then the ice changes the kind of the Coke. And then the kind of Coke, he was one of the first people to get Mexican Coke. He was a freak about it. Because Mexican Coke is, as everybody knows, superior to American Coke.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, no comparison.
They have, what, like 400 different recipes, and they're all catering to different regions of the earth.
Different regions. And there's one particular, the part where Baja's Mexican Coke is like the original Coke.
Yeah.
That was, it's just more expensive because it's the real sugar. It's not the stuff, the refined. It's sugar.
Sugar cane.
Yeah, sugar cane.
From the Better cane. Than McDonald's?
No, McDonald's is the best ever.
Okay.
McDonald's has a special recipe from Coke.
Yeah.
And some of them said, for screw it, just give us the mass stuff at a vat. So you'll go to some McDonald's, especially ones where the Coke's given by the people behind. And then they have a special mix, and they have a special extra amount of syrup that they put in. They put in more syrup.
Secret Coke.
Oh, no. And I literally, there are hundreds of thousands of people who literally know the McDonald's that serve the special McDonald's soda. And it's not every McDonald's because it costs more. It's actually quite a bit more. It's like 3 or 4 cents a drink, which sounds like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But
and
in the overall mix of all that soda, they'll go screw it. The damn customers don't know. There was one McDonald's in Baltimore where I stopped going when they changed it.
Mm.
And I used to like drive 20 minutes. And I don't think they ever figured it out. Yeah, no, it, you know. I know, it's a little sad, isn't it?
How did you find out that you just tasted the change?
Yeah, I tasted it. I also knew. I mean, I would always look. Him? I look, yeah. I didn't have, I could taste it. I don't need to ask. I mean, if you're at self-serve, it's not that. Because once you go to self-serve, then they just go to the traditional mixes. So it had to come from the back.
Okay.
And there's a couple of other restaurants that did that deal with McDonald's. Chick-fil-A did it for the longest time. And then I don't know what happened. I don't
really?
Know if they paid. Yeah, because there just became too many people who hadn't been. Here's what it came from. The people who ever had an original Coke from the soda fountain, from the ice cream parlor, knew that you could say to the man with the hat, and especially if you had the seltzer really cold, you'd say, give me an extra shot of the syrup. And he would just go this. And I mean, you'd be flying for the whole day. And it just tasted freaking great. But, you know, each jolt of the syrup. You know, he's, you know, if it was 12 cents for the Coke, he's saying, you know, 15
right.
or whatever. It's like extra hot fudge on your hot fudge at the Baskin.
It's like an extra shot in your coffee.
It's like an extra shot of whatever. Absolutely. So,
well, there you have it. And these guys love to make fun of me, and I'm happy
great.
To have them do it.
My
that
jaw
was
hurts.
Fun. Oh, come on. You guys don't have a food obsession. Jesse, what's your food obsession? What bugs you about a certain food? Or what are you obsessed with? It's got to be a certain way, or you can't eat it. A peanut butter and jelly sandwich, something. Something where anybody makes it one way, you're not going to eat it another way.
I think meatballs need to be large.
So small meatballs are out.
Small meatballs are out. It's almost an insult. Somebody sets it on your plate, and it's not, you know... It's got to be a big meatball.
It's got to be a real meatball. And Greg, come on. I mean, I don't even want to go. This might take an hour.
Yeah, I don't know.
One thing that you would go out of your way 20 minutes for. Drive.
Oh, yeah. When I lived in Los Angeles, I drove 45 minutes to get these gluten-free vegan pancakes at this hippie restaurant. It's a grocery store and a restaurant in one from the 60s or 70s. And you go in there and it's just really freaky, but the food, it's just a vegan restaurant. But it's great. I mean, I drove all the time, and I'd have to convince my whole family. But on my birthdays, we were always
that there. Was it. And I know, Alex, you don't even have to tell me, because you would get on a plane right now and go to Big Al's for one of those, you know, what are they called? What kind of steak is it? Or?
Oh, the combo with the Italian beef and the sausage in the same sandwich.
In the same sandwich.
Yeah.
First time we go there, I know what it's all about. Alex wants me to take meetings in Chicago. Next thing you know, he's pulling me around the whole place to all of his favorite eats. We love to talk about everything here on Our American Stories. This is our water cooler segment. Where would you go and how far would you go to grab that food you love?
There's
20
a
minutes.
Cooler.
That's fine.
After a lot of coffee.
Oh, where would you go in 20 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes for some special food? This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. A lot of foolishness, a lot of stories, and more. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org, and everything we do is there. More after this. Yeah. This is Lee Habib, and it's Our American Stories. And it's time now for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, and the liberal arts, all the things that matter in life. And in this feature, you're about to meet someone you've definitely heard of, but likely don't know much about.
Some people call me the space cowboy. Yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice. 'Cause I speak of the pompous of love.
Fighter pilot. War hero. Son. MIT rocket scientist, father. He has been all these things and a lot more things, but he's mostly remembered for one thing, something he's a little tired of being asked about. After 60 years of it, you might have been too. He's also tired of it because it's not enough to him. It's something we did, he says. Now we should do something else. His name is Buzz Aldrin. And that something he did, that one thing, was being the second man to ever walk on the moon, answering his president's call of duty.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
You'd think his vanity license plate would be Moon Guy, yet it's Mars Guy. It's that something else he thinks we should do. Mars. Born in Montclair, New Jersey, Buzz Aldrin's mother had the maiden name Moon. Coincidence, you ask? I don't think so. His real name is Edwin, but his sister couldn't say brother. The name Buzzer just kept coming out of her mouth, and the nickname Buzz sticked. His country is glad it did, and Edwin walking on the moon is not nearly as profound as a Buzz doing so. Buzz was a Boy Scout, as so many great men are. He was also shaped by his family, in good ways and in bad.
Check ignition, and may God's love be with you.
His grandfather put a bullet through his brain. His mom swallowed pills to her death. His father was almost too alive in his life. A career military man, his father knew Amelia Earhart, one of the Wright brothers, and took a transatlantic flight on the Hindenburg before it blew up. He wanted his only boy, Buzz, to be just like him, brave and brilliant. But Buzz was shy and sensitive. And he drove himself to his father's dreams for him. When he flew combat missions in the Korean War and was decorated with the Distinguished Flying Cross, his father said, "And?" And so he went to MIT and earned a doctorate of science in astronautics. These elite experiences led him to NASA, and when he walked on the moon, his dad said, "And?" The second man to walk on the moon? Number two? His father was so affected by it that he waged a one-man campaign to get the Postal Service to change its Neil Armstrong First Man on the Moon commemorative stamp to one that said First Men on the Moon, so it could include Buzz. He would lose. And Buzz would lose something much greater when he returned home. As GQ magazine put it, he discovered the melancholy of all things done. He was a conqueror with nothing left to conquer but his own demons. NASA had no more use for Buzz. They sent him around the world like a PR flak. Even though he was a scientist, his mind was left idle. Buzz resigned and returned to the Air Force, but they didn't exactly know what to do with an academic who had just been to the moon. And so Buzz picked up the bottle. He put down his marriage to the mother of his three children. He retired and went into rehab. Tried out marriage again for a year and drank some more. A Cadillac dealership sounded like a good place to go, but he didn't sell very many of them. As if it could get any worse, he created this song with Snoop Dogg.
Are you ready to put on your spacesuit? Strap in for the G-Force liftoff. Countdown is getting very close now to the adventure of a lifetime.
If his life tells us anything, it's that we are complex human beings, all with our own crosses, all capable of our own triumphs, all with a need for love in our lives, especially the love of a father and a mother. To close our tribute to Buzz Aldrin, an American great, born on this day in history in 1930, we take you to his telling of his time on the moon. First with seeing his friend Neil Armstrong becoming the first man to ever set foot on the moon.
It was absolutely correct that the captain, the commander, make the first descent and walk on the moon.
Two men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969, A.D.
We came in peace for all mankind. That statement really, to me, was a very symbolic one of not just our mission, but all of the Apollo effort.
They've got the flag up now, and you can see the stars and stripes on the Olympic. Beautiful, just beautiful. Beautiful, just beautiful.
If you look real close, you can see that I'm saluting the flag. And for a military person, that was indeed a very, very proud moment to be on the moon saluting the flag.
And then Buzz did something a little more reflective. He radioed over to NASA.
This is the LM pilot. I'd like to take this opportunity to ask every person listening in, whoever and wherever they may be, to pause for a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours and to give thanks in his or her own way.
Ending his radio communication, he then read from the Gospel of John, chapter 15, verse 5, which says,
I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever remains in me and I in him will bear much fruit, for you can do nothing without me.
Buzz said of this verse, I read the words which I had chosen to indicate our trust that as man probes into space, we are in fact acting in Christ. I sensed especially strongly my unity with our church back home and with the church everywhere, and then took communion. Later recounting in Guidepost magazine, I ate the tiny host and swallowed the wine. I gave thanks for the intelligence and spirit that had brought two young pilots to the Sea of Tranquility. It was interesting for me to think, the very first liquid ever poured on the moon and the very first food eaten there were the communion elements. Buzz Aldrin marked his territory in his own special way, and marked what he saw as God's territory in his special way. Although NASA wouldn't let him share with the world what he had done. But in the end, who's going to stop Buzz Aldrin? At least for as long as he continues to wear jockey underwear. Jockey, supporting greatness since 1876.
And I think it's gonna be a long, long time.
That's just a fantastic piece of work, Greg. Great job. And my goodness, I wasn't prepared for that.
It's great.
What a life. And we don't do simple things here. Complex human beings, complex lives. Affirmative anytime we can get a chance. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. You can catch all of this on OurAmericanNetwork.org.
think it's gonna be a long, long time. The sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. Lighten up while you still can. Don't even try to understand. Just find a place to make your stand. And take it easy. Well, I'm standing on a corner in Winslow, Arizona, and such a fine sight to see.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Glenn Frey singing the song that propelled the Eagles into stardom, a Jackson Brown song written by Jackson, their dear friend, who taught them everything they needed to know about songwriting. We'll get to that in a bit. Jackson Brown wrote most of that song. The reason we played it as long as we did is Glenn Frey made a key contribution, not only singing it, but when Jackson got stumped partway through, he turned to his pal, Glenn, who finished the second verse, starting with, such a fine sight to see, it's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down to take a look at me. And it unleashed the song for Jackson, so he put a co-write on that for Glenn Frey, his friend. Because it wouldn't have been a song without it, and it's true, he was stuck, and I see why. When you read the lyrics, you'll get it. And so for the next two segments, we're going to talk about Glenn and his life's work, hear from him, hear his music. Born in Detroit, kicked around, played with Seeger's band, moved to L.A., and joined a pack of musicians and songwriters that dominated music in the 1970s. And he and Don Henley became as good a writing duo as there's ever been in the United States, right up there with Rodgers and Hammerstein, and, well, Bernie Taupin and Elton John from England. Why a musician, though? Why a band? Because Glenn Frey had a solo career, but in the end, always returning to the band.
Just love singing with other people and finding harmony parts and blending and coming in at the same time and scooping and cutting off right. And, you know, it's really is a lot of fun.
It really is a lot of fun. And by the way, that's why so many guys join bands. I know it's why my sister did. You don't fit in high school as an athlete. You can't find your clique in academics. You're feeling a little lonely, a little awkward. You want to connect. You get an axe. You play the piano. You join the theater. You join the student newspaper. That's generally the impulse. And I know a lot of musicians, and they'll be nodding when I say that. So he moves to L.A., meets Jackson Brown, who's really a writer. And these guys are trying to become writers. They don't want to just be musicians because the singer-songwriter is what's most respected in the business, and those are the guys who make all the money, and they get all the girls. And so they're living in Echo Park in a little tiny apartment, and right next door is their buddy at Jackson Brown. And this clip, you're going to hear why Glenn Frey and the band owe so much to Jackson, because they learned how hard Jackson worked and that it was a craft, this thing called songwriting.
You know, that was it. It was like a stereo, a piano, a bed, a guitar, you know, a teapot.
We slept late in those days. Except around 9 o'clock in the morning, I'd hear Jackson Brown's teapot going off with this whistle in the distance. And then I'd hear him playing piano. I didn't really know how to write songs. I knew I wanted to write songs, but I didn't know exactly. You just wait around for inspiration, you know, what was the deal? Well, I learned through the Jackson ceiling and my floor exactly how to write songs, because Jackson would get up and he'd play the first verse and first chorus, and he'd play it 20 times until he had it just the way he wanted. And then there'd be silence. And then I'd hear the teapot go off again. And it'd be quiet for 10 or 20 minutes. Then I'd hear him start to play again, and there was a second verse. So then he'd work on the second verse, and he'd play it 20 times. And then he'd go back to the top of the song, and he'd play the first verse, the first chorus, and the second verse another 20 times until he was really comfortable with it and, you know, change a word here or there. And I'm up there going, so that's how you do it. Elbow grease, you know, time, thought, persistence.
Elbow grease, time, thought, persistence. It was a craft. It was hard work. You didn't just sit around waiting for inspiration. If you were at the keyboards, that's when the inspiration would come. Well, he was asked what his two favorite songs were. Here's what he said.
I'd probably put Take It Easy in because it was the first Eagles song and really sort of was America's and everybody's first image of our band, you know. And I think it was the vistas of the Southwest and, you know, it was the beginnings of what became country rock. Mm-hmm. I would put in Desperado, which is the first song Don Henley and I wrote together. And I think I was 24 and Don was 26. And to think that 20 years later, you know, this song would stand the test of time, would still be being recorded by people and performed by people, I would put that in there. One of These Nights, my personal favorite Eagles song along with I Can't Tell You Why. I think I would put, those are two of my personal favorites.
Well, those were a few, and then, of course, so many others, which he would go on to list in this interview with Bob Costas some time ago. Back in, I think, in the mid-1990s, wasn't it, Jesse? Something way back then? And one of them was Desperado. And so many people read so much into this song. Let's take a listen to that classic.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you can hurt you somehow. Don't you draw the queen of diamonds, boy. She'll beat you if she's able. You know the queen of hearts is always your best bet. Now it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the ones that you can't get.
Like he said, he loved the singing and sounds of other voices and other guitars. He had a solo career, but in the end, he was always most at home with his boys, with Don Henley, writing with him, letting Don sing his songs, him singing his, him singing ones that Don mostly wrote. Let's take a listen to another one as we go out on the break, one he loved, and that's Peaceful Easy Feeling.
I like the way your sparkling earrings lay against your skin so brown. And I want to sleep with you in the
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. The life of Glenn Frey. More after this on Our American Stories. Found out a long time ago what a
another tequila sunrise, staring slowly across the sky. Said goodbye. He was just a hired hand, working on the dreams he planned to try. The days go by.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're talking about Glenn Frey's life, his music. We're hearing from Glenn himself about his own life, about writing, about the band. And they had hit after hit, but they really hit their stride when Joe Walsh got added to the band. They hit their creative peak with a little record called Hotel California, which ended up selling 16 million records that year and 40 million worldwide. And here's Glenn Frey talking about that record and why, in his opinion, it was the Eagles' best.
That was probably our best record as far as making a record is concerned. I think Hotel California, the album, and Hotel California, the song, were probably the zenith of the Eagles in that what we had to say came together with our learning of how to make records. And that song was co-written with Don Henley and also with Don Felder, an often not recognized but integral part of the Eagles in the second half of the band.
Yeah, we learned in an earlier, we did about a half hour on just the song about 3 months ago. You can catch it on OurAmericanNetwork.org. And it turned out that Don sent loops to the guys, to Don Felder, sent loops to Don Henley and Glenn Frey. And they love this loop, which would turn into the song Hotel California. Let's take a listen to some of the really remarkable lyrics, though, in this, well, American classic. You almost hate stopping it because it's telling such a story. And by the way, ask any five people what that story is about, and you'll hear five different answers. And probably ask those same people a year later, and you'll hear five new answers, depending on where they are in their life and what they're going through at that time in their life. Like so many really great pieces of art, which this was. And here's Glenn Frey talking about why this song was so great.
Don and I talked about that song, and you know, we were big big Steely Dan fans. Mm-hmm. We were always quite amazed that Steely Dan was so brave lyrically. They got the Steely Dan T-shirts. You know, they had lines in their songs that we would sort of looked at ourselves and says, "Whoa, would we have put that in one of our songs?" We started talking about Hotel California and wanted to sort of write a song that was sort of like an episode of The Twilight Zone. All of our songs were cinematic, but we wanted to open up it was just one shot to the next, and they didn't necessarily make sense. It was just picture of the guy on the highway, picture of the hotel, picture, you know, and the guy walks in, the door opens, strange people, and it's just sort of following this guy, and it doesn't really make sense.
It doesn't really make sense, but yet in the end it does. Later on in that interview with Bob Costas, he talked about how the song had a sort of perfect ambiguity, which was the goal they were after, and a mood and a series of images they were going after as well. You know, Bob Seger was asked, and he was a friend of Glenn's, what broke up the Eagles, and he said there are two words. Hotel California. The odd thing about the really remarkable status these guys achieved is that the critics really didn't like them. In fact, I'm going to read you the opening of this CNN piece on Glenn's passing, and here's what they said. This is the lead. It was hard to turn on the radio in the 1970s without hearing a song by Glenn Frey, the founding member of the Eagles who died Monday at age 67. He co-wrote or sang almost all of the band's biggest hits, such as Tequila Sunrise, New Kid in Town, and Heartache Tonight. Whatever you may think of the country-tinged California rock band, and some critics hated them, boom, there it is. I mean, he just dies, and they're throwing in that lots of people hated him. Does that happen to any other gigantic band? Just very strange. They were never respected. I believe a lot of it had to do because they were, A, so good-looking, they so together, they sounded so beautiful. Everybody else was going through early grunge, acid. It was the Woodstock, Haight Ashbury, rebellious sound. Even Led Zeppelin, you'd go to the stage, he was unkempt, the band was unkempt. These guys were scrubbed, and they were from Southern California. Oh, my goodness, nothing serious could come from Southern California. But the music was great. The musicianship was great. And, okay, say it's not your thing, but the way these guys got dumped on, it just wasn't deserved. Let's hear Glenn Frey talking about his critics.
Now, I really believe, you know, firmly that if you're getting bad reviews, you're doing something right.
But don't they hurt?
Well, we used to have a list, you know, which was sort of punch them on sight. There was a punch them on sight list, you know, and we were protective not only of our own music, but I think what really hurt was when we'd see people rail Jackson Browne or J.D. South or Souther Hillman and Furey,
yeah.
Or, you know, people that we knew, you know, not just ourselves. But I think you have to, you know, you have to understand, you know, that these people sit at typewriters and, you know, in little funky corners of the world and sort of wish they were doing what we were doing. We didn't get a lot of good reviews. Got a lot of good reviews live. You know, our show was, you know, we used to get good reviews toward the end. But, you know, we were never the darlings of the critics. And that suits me just fine.
That was just a beautiful description of these guys pounding away at their typewriters, wishing they could be musicians. I feel the same way about a lot of sports writers. If you can't do it, well, then let me gain power over those that can by criticizing them and letting them know whether I deem their record worthy or not. What a thing to do for a living, actually. You couldn't pay me all the money in the world to be a rock critic or a theater critic. I know how hard doing these things are. And love on stuff that's good. And if it's not your style, so what? So much of our identities are tied up in a certain type of music. I had so many friends who, because they love metal, they couldn't listen to country or even rock. And the Stones people didn't listen to the Beatles people. And I said, can't you listen to both? Aren't they just good? Can't you at least appreciate both? One of my favorites and the first song that I fell in love with the Eagles was Lion Eyes. Let's take a listen. I just love the way that song starts. Who starts a song off like that? City girls just seem to find out early how to open doors with just a smile. I'm in. You got me. You hooked me. That's the thing. I love the Stones because they're a great guitar hooks. But I love the Eagles because they're a great lyrical hooks. They're different. But they're the same. And that's what music's about. Hooking us. Taking us to another place. And we want to close things out with that song Hotel California again, because remember what Glenn Frey said at the beginning. He loved the sound and clank of the guitars. He loved the voices. And you could always watch him in concert. And when it finally got to those dueling guitars at the end, he would just sit there and let the two lead guitarists duel it out. And he was just so happy watching his boys play. He wasn't taking the leads, but he was watching them. So let's take a listen to this classic song, this great ending, and what a great life, well-lived, Glenn Frey. And here's Hotel California's guitar solo. This is Lee Habib, the life of Glenn Frey, and this is Our American Stories. Great job as always on this, Jesse, and the whole team.
Just love singing with other people, finding harmony parts and blending, coming in at the same time, scooping, cutting off right. It is a lot of fun.